Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
The Senate voted yesterday to block the For the People Voting Rights Bill, but not until they got their voting paperwork in order. Let's see, I got my license, passport, tax returns, high school yearbook. Okay, I think I'm ready for my riddle.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. On today's show, Seth chats with former President Bill Clinton and author James Patterson. But first, a closer look.
An upcoming book reveals shocking new details about the Trump administration's criminally negligent COVID response, and Republicans blocked a voting rights bill as part of their ongoing attempt to dismantle our democracy. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. As eager as we all are to get back to normal, we can't lose sight of the fact that the COVID pandemic is still very much with us. Vaccination rates in parts of the country are lagging. Case numbers in some states are rising. A dangerous new variant is driving up infections in the UK, and models predict a possible surge of cases in the fall. And even as things get better overall, there are still constant reminders of how much our world has changed in the last 16 months. Every time I reach across the counter at my local coffee shop to grab my iced oat latte from the barista, only to accidentally punch the plexiglass partition that's still there to stop the spread of contagious droplets from a deadly disease, I think to myself, all right, COVID. Not that I should note the glass does anything. I'm pretty sure aerosols can find their way around a glass partition. It's like trying to keep ants out of your house with a sign. We're also constantly reminded, even 5 months after he left office, that Trump's response to the pandemic was somehow much worse and much crazier than we even knew at the time. Every day, we keep hearing new details about his time in office, thanks to what seems like a never-ending parade of tell-all books scheduled for publication, each filled with more damning new details about just how much of a sociopath he was. There are so many Trump books on the shelves that he's bleeding into other books. The other day, my son found him next to Waldo. He's right here, kid. He's right here. And they all have titles that make them sound like straight-to-DVD Steven Seagal movies, Nightmare Scenario, Inflection Point, Tipping Point, Hoax, Rage, Fear, Fire, Fury, Fire and Fury, Fire and Fury 2, The Firest and the Furious. I mean, these people actually read these? We all lived with a knot in our belly for 4 years. Who wants to read an 800-page deep dive about that? Be like reading a book called The Time You Waved at Sarah, but She Was Waving at Someone Behind You. Maybe they're all just those cutout books you can use to hide your weed from your dog walker. Besides, don't we all just get the craziest tidbits cherry-picked for us on Twitter or cable news or from late-night talk shows? Oh, and speaking of which, here's a cable news clip with a tidbit from a new Trump tell-all.
Stunning revelations this morning about the Trump administration's response during the early days of the pandemic. In a new book entitled Nightmare Scenario, Washington Post journalists Yasmin Abutaleb and Damian Paletta report how President Trump suggested sending Americans with COVID-19 to Guantanamo Bay.
The book draws on early conversations as told by staffers and government leaders like this one, when White House officials debated whether to bring infected Americans home. Quote, Don't we have an island that we own? The president reportedly asked those assembled in the sit room in February 2020 before the U.S. outbreak would explode. Quote, what about Guantanamo? Aides were stunned, and when Trump brought it up a second time, they quickly scuttled the idea.
Only Trump would refer to Guantanamo Bay as an island that we own. It's such a reminder that he will always, first and foremost, be a real estate guy. Also, Guantanamo Bay is not an island, you dolt. It's right there in the name. It's a naval base and detention camp on the island of Cuba, an island we do not own because, and I'm not a history buff, but I think this is right, JFK couldn't pass the co-op board. I will say, it would have been hilarious watching Trump try to rebrand Guantanamo as a fun place for people to spend a week. Welcome to Guantanalago Spa and Resort. Make sure you check out the bay. I heard it is full of pigs. Also, was there like a fantasy football draft, but for the stories each staffer got to tell for their books? I can't decide between the time he wanted to send cruise ship passengers to Gitmo or the time he asked if he could legally send SEAL Team 6 to rough up Lorne Michaels.
So, I'm up late reading first edition Evelyn Waugh, and I see that little red dot on the wall that they have on sniper rifles, and from that moment I knew it's SEAL Team 6.
The Trump era was a catastrophe of unprecedented proportions, and yet Republicans are hell-bent on repeating it if they get a chance. That's why they're passing a barrage of voter suppression bills that would allow them to overturn future election results, and why they blocked the For the People Voting Rights Bill yesterday. And yet, even with that brewing crisis on the horizon, there's a small group of Democratic senators who are still super concerned with preserving the filibuster and giving Republicans a veto over their agenda, like Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema, who made some truly ludicrous arguments in favor of the filibuster in an op-ed earlier this week.
Kyrsten Sinema wrote for the Washington Post. She said, to those who want to eliminate the legislative filibuster to pass the For the People Act, voting rights legislation I support and have co-sponsored, I would ask, would it be good for our country if we did, only to see that legislation rescinded a few years from now and replaced by a nationwide voter ID law or restrictions on voting by mail in federal elections over the objections of the minority?
Well, that's just how democracy works. You pass laws, and then if your opponents take power, they can change those laws, unless you rally public opinion to your side, which is your job as a politician. Didn't any of you people watch Schoolhouse Rock as a kid? Although I'm guessing in Sinema's case, she watched more, I don't know, music videos by ska bands? She looks like she's going to a Mighty Mighty Boston's concert in 1992. At least, that's the impression that I get. Your job is to make progress and then fight to protect that progress by galvanizing popular support. You can't just resign yourself to doing nothing because Republicans might eventually undo whatever bill you pass. For one thing, that's not a given. Republicans couldn't get rid of Obamacare, even with a simple majority, because it was super popular and people were outraged. Also, Republicans don't seem to care if they get support from Democrats. In fact, they're doing the opposite. Across the country, they're passing voter suppression bills on party line votes.
I followed all of these debates. They were party line, simple majority debates in Georgia, in Arizona,
yes,
in Florida, in all of these states, making it harder to vote. And Republicans didn't say, oh, what will the Democrats say about us? We need bipartisanship. The entire point of voter suppression is to make it harder for your opponents to be able to vote. And so there's just two standards here. There's the game being played by Republicans in the states, where they do whatever they can to undermine democracy. Then there's the game being played by Democrats in Washington, where they fail to protect American democracy because of these arcane rules that nobody actually cares about. And in 100 years, nobody's going to care about the filibuster if the right to vote is undermined for decades.
He's right. No one gives a about the filibuster. Most people don't even know where it came from, why it exists, why it's called a filibuster, or where that word even came from. True story, it's a Dutch word, vrijbouwer, which translates to freebooter and was used to mean pirate. So by respecting the filibuster, we're loosely supporting pirates, which makes sense because basically Mitch McConnell's entire career has been him boarding the SS Democracy and saying, I'm the captain now. Too long a walk to get to the McConnell impression? Just long enough? I hope it was worth it because it's a real strain on my vocal cords. Not the part just now, the hours of vocal warm-ups.
Oh, red leather, yellow leather, the jolly collie swallowed a lollipop.
Anyway, no one cares about the filibuster, and Democrats like Sinema and Joe Manchin need to stop playing by different self-imposed rules than Republicans. When Trump supporters were scaling the walls of the Capitol to overthrow the government, they weren't like, oh, man, I hope the Democrats are cool with this. Should we have invited some of them, you know, just for optics? The difference with Republicans is so infuriating. Democrats are worried that if they lose the next election, their legislation could get overturned, while Republicans are still trying to overturn the last election. In Arizona, the sham election audit has gotten so insane, they're hunting for bamboo ballots and secret watermarks and sending copies of voting data to a mysterious laboratory in a remote location in Montana.
On this piece of property in a remote part of Montana, people may at this very minute be analyzing voting data from the state of Arizona as part of the so-called Arizona audit.
So as you might expect, we're left wondering where in the state of Montana are the copies of this voting data being analyzed? Where is the secure, powerful lab? So could the information be here? We could tell you as we walk up here, the first thing you see on this big piece of land is a sign. Private property, trespassing for any purpose is strictly forbidden. Violators will be prosecuted. So we can't cross this area. We can show you, though, from this area, what looks like a cabin on this property. Is this the secure, powerful laboratory? Is Arizona voting data inside that cabin? We just don't know, but it could be.
Dude, be careful on the side of the highway or people are going to think you're a hitchhiker. Anderson, I'm currently in a windowless white van with a man named Rex who says I can crash with him for the night and have all the ice cream I want as long as I make a sacrifice of fresh deer meat to the wood spirit, Galthkamar. Back to you, Anderson. That's how insane things are right now. CNN reporters are hunting for voting data on the side of a highway three states away because Republican shipped it to a secret location in the middle of nowhere with no outside observers in the name of election integrity. This is all starting to sound like a storyline from the next season of Ozark, which, thanks to his Netflix deal, stars Barack Obama. Laura, we gotta find the ballots or the cartel will come after us. Sir, her character's name is Wendy. Well, let's dub it in later. ADR it! I'm in a groove. Every day we find out more about just how much of a nightmare the Trump era was, and every day Republicans do whatever they can to force that nightmare on us again. They're passing bills across the country, making it easier to overturn the next election, and sending voting data to mysterious locations to overturn the last election. The guessing game about where Arizona Republicans sent all that voting data is getting so crazy, eventually we're going to have to ask,
what about Guantanamo?
This has been A Closer Look.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Our first guests tonight are the co-authors of the number one New York Times bestseller, The President's Daughter, which is out now. Please welcome to the show, President Bill Clinton and James Patterson. Welcome, gentlemen. Here we are, big time authors.
So cool. I get a couch.
You get a whole couch. We saw.
Yeah, you might get recline.
We were going to have two chairs, but then we heard your rider insisted that you have your own couch. Now, I want to start by clarifying. This is about your previous book was about a president going missing. This is about a president's daughter going missing. Different president.
Different president.
And out of office.
And out of office. So there
just out of office.
Where do you get your ideas? A president out of office.
Yeah, what a crazy idea.
Well, this actually is I think, has a very interesting premise because what you find when you leave the White House, things change. I mean, they don't play a song when you walk in the room anymore.
Yeah.
And you keep your Secret Service protection for yourself and your spouse, but it's less, and your children over 18 don't get it.
Oh, I didn't realize they lose it after 18.
And so this is a story about how the things you do when you're president that have consequences other people don't like can follow you out of the office and fall on your children.
Obviously, in your books, these are very, they're thrillers. A lot of extreme things happen, and yet we've seen since your first book in 2018, even more extreme events happen with real presidents. Has it been harder to write things that make people say, wow, that's
amazing.
Back
in the 60s, Philip Roth, because we had Nixon and Vietnam, and he said, I can't compete. I'll never write fiction again. Yeah. He then eventually did write fiction again. But that is an issue right now.
Yeah, but if you look what happened with the latest cybersecurity stuff, our book looks pretty realistic.
Yeah.
And this is also very important because you're living in this world where these, you know, people can be omnipresent for all kinds of reasons everywhere. And what you do when you're president follows you afterward. So then you have to figure out, I mean, this is made more interesting by the alienation of the president from his successor and the uncertainty the former president has that his child is going to be a top priority. So you get a lot of interesting cross currents here.
I have heard that you, and I think when we picture presidents reading, we picture them reading briefings or maybe reading nonfiction, but you did find time in office to read fiction. Was that something that helped as an escape from the rigors of the job, or did you actually find inspiration in the pages of fiction when you were in office?
Oh, both. I started in the early 80s, I started reading thrillers, mysteries, detective novels. I was always fascinated by them. And I found them, the good ones, really in, you know, great character portraits.
Yeah, a lot of the presidents, I actually read a lot of thrillers. The Bushes both did, President Clinton. I don't know about President Trump, but whatever.
He lived it. It was a thrill. It was a thrill ride.
But anyway, I read, on occasion, I would read fiction books because I thought they might be an omen of what to do. And I read The Hot Zone, Richard Preston's The Hot Zone, and it really accelerated my efforts to get the White House to set up a special unit on dealing with biological and chemical outbreaks, and especially in the biological area, both deliberate biological warfare and the possibility of pandemics. And we started working on this in about 1998, and that's, we had a lot of plans out. We did a lot of kind of war gaming, I mean, real efforts with security people all over America. And we set up the first stockpile. So I've been waiting for what happened with COVID. And we were, look, with SARS, with MERS, with all this stuff, we were given plenty of advance warning that something like this could happen.
Now, James, as an author who's aware that you have presidents in office who are reading books and oftentimes reading your books, do you have a sense of the power you might have to influence based on what you put in your pages?
I have no power. I'm here with Seth. I'm here with the President Clinton. I'm the third wheel, and that's the way it is in life. You know how it is for writers. You're a writer.
Yes, I'm a writer, and oftentimes...
Nobody listens to us.
Yeah, that's nobody listens to him. That's how he sold 400 million books.
I mean, I didn't say they don't read me. They just don't listen to me.
Yeah. What? When do you guys ever have arguments about a plot point? And then is that a situation, James, where a former president maybe pulls rank on even someone who sold 400 million
books? We've never had an argument. I mean, we'll talk about the different. You know, one of the things I think that separates us, because a lot of the books, a lot of thriller, we make stuff up. If I'm writing with the president, some of the stuff might be a little over the top, although nothing's over the top these days. But the president makes sure that if it happens, this is how it would happen. And he's very strict about that. And that's, I think, what separates these books.
We don't have arguments. What we really have is we have interesting discussions because now that I've done this twice, basically as a student of a master, what I have learned is we start with an outline. We have a beginning, we think we know what the end is, and we have an outline. But then these people become real as you write about them.
Yeah.
And the scenes become vivid. And so the storylines begin to take a little different turn. And so one of the things that we'd have to do, like in this last book we did it, at the end we have to say, hey, we're going to have two loose ends here. Let's figure out how we're going to tie them up. And then, you know,
the endings almost always change. And when I do, and it's true with the books that we do together, I like to pretend there's one person sitting across from me, and I don't want them to get up till we finish the story. And that's kind of what we try to do with The President's Daughter.
I can only imagine what it's like the way you write must be so fast, James, based on output. Are you someone that responded to the process? I mean, I know it's every 2 years, but you've certainly written other books.
But it wasn't necessarily every 2 years. I don't know that we missed each other. That's why we got back together, you know.
We had a good time.
We said, let's do another one, yeah.
Hillary is writing a book as well.
We're not going to talk about that. Let her come here and she can sell her own book.
Yeah, no, I've heard this, James. I've heard you're very competitive, yeah.
Yeah, and she's doing it with Louise Penny, who is a fabulous mystery writer and a good friend of ours.
Yes.
So there's a little bit of gender as well as friendship competition here. And I've read the book. It's a really good book. It's going to be
unfortunately.
Released.
No, it is.
There's a lot of room for everybody to succeed, James.
There's very little room at the number one spot. There's number one and, you know.
Well, I mean, you know, the important thing is that you get your name out there. I think that's a really important thing for you. Right. I want to talk about what's going on in politics right now. You know, we see the current president is using a lot of the levers of power that are available to him in taking steps, hopefully in something as big as infrastructure. I mean, he's getting checks in the American people's pocket. We obviously have a great many people in this country in elected office who speak ill of big government. Would you make the case, based on the time we're living in right now, that sometimes big government is a helpful tool?
Sometimes it's helpful. It always can be helpful if it's properly directed. But in a time like this, it's essential. Look, don't forget, I gave you the first balanced budget in 3 decades, and we did 3 in a row, and I left a fourth, and we paid $600 billion down on the national debt, which was real money back then. This is not that kind of time. We had a crash in 2008, which blew a $3 trillion hole in the economy. Then we have the coronavirus crash, which was bigger. For all the stimulus money that's been spent, we're still about 3 million jobs short of where we were before this thing started. When there is negative growth and zero interest rates, only the government can provide the impetus to jumpstart the economy. And since we're doing it, the president has a plan to try to shape the future with modernized infrastructure, including broadband for all these small towns and rural areas, and a lot of transfer to clean energy, but things that are generating jobs, and a big plan to help small businesses. And if we hadn't done that, God only knows how many million people would have been thrown out of our apartments. Too many lost their jobs as it was. So, yeah, I think people need to just park this cussing the government for a while. Let's get the thing back to, ground zero and start growing again. Then we can argue about how much the government should do.
And it does seem to be the discussion du jour in American politics is, what would you do about the filibuster if it was up to you?
Well, the filibuster was set up to ensure prolonged debate. It was used in the civil rights era to try to kill civil rights bills. And starting in about 1994, it started to be used all the time. And it was used on President Obama. So it's now been used to try to prevent a repeat of 2020 when we had the enormous voter participation. So all the states that are in the hands of people who don't like that and want to maintain a racial income differential or trying to make it harder to vote. I understand the president's reluctant to get rid of it altogether. And I'm sympathize with Joe Manchin, who's trying to, stand up for the right thing and represent people that voted more than 2-1 for President Trump. But I think when it comes to preserving democracy, I would suspend the filibuster because I think it's essential. I don't think that we should be in the business of going backwards in trying to drive down voting rights. I think we need to expand it. And I think that every time we've done it before, it's made us a better country, made us a stronger country. And it'll do both parties good to have to get out and compete for all these new voters. So yes, if it were me, for this one purpose, I would not allow an expansion and basically a protection of voting rights. These guys are trying to take us back decades in voting axis, the people that Senator McConnell represents.
James, you've had in your books, The President's Gone Missing, The President's Daughter's Gone Missing.
What's
I
next?
Sense a theme. You know, if there's going to be a trilogy of books from you guys, what do you think?
I know, people really like animals, so, you know.
It does feel like,
puppies.
A puppy, the president. Maybe it's a whole litter.
Could be,
The president's dog has a litter and they all go missing.
Yeah, you never know.
The president wants him to go missing. Will he do that?
We're in talks.
You're in talks. When do you know, last question, when do you know the book is done? Like, when you guys are working on it, is it your job to say, as the expert, like, this is it, we got it, send it off?
Once again, it's just never come up. But the other thing that the president does is he really insists that the characters are as deep as we can make them, as complex, rounded characters. And that's probably the last thing that we do in terms of, all right, this villain is a cliche rather than a real human being. And that's probably the last thing we do. And at a certain point, I just go, I give up. It's over. It's done. It's done. And then there it is, the president's daughter.
Well, congratulations.
Thanks.
I do think both of you, not just one of you, both of you are going places. And I mean, the president's daughter's out now.
Late Night with Seth Meyers airs weeknights on NBC at 12:35, 11:35 Central. Original music on the Late Night podcast is by the HE Band. Don't forget to follow the handle Late Night Seth on social media and tell your friends to subscribe to the Late Night podcast wherever they get their podcasts.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.